Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 8th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on wildfires, and then we'll turn towards Valley and State news, and then conclude the first hour with national and world news from USA Today. This feature front page article from today's Republic is entitled, Hoping to Avoid Disaster. The subtitle is, In the Midst of a Dry Winter, Images of the California Wildfire Struck Fear in the Hearts of Arizonans. Some cities are more prepared than others. This is by Joan Miners. As the Palisades and Eaton fires ravaged neighborhoods across Los Angeles throughout January, Flagstaff residents watched nervously from afar, refreshing weather forecasts, hoping for any hint of moisture on the way. By the time the California flames were finally extinguished on January 31st, Arizona's largest forested city had logged just 5.9 total inches of snow so far that winter, 12% of the 49.1-inch average by that date, and just over half the previous record low of 10.2 inches set in 1934. The numbers threaten the state's water supply for the coming years. Noah Baker, the city's wildfire, climate, and community health specialist, knew the numbers also likely meant a long, fiery summer ahead. A member of the city's sustainability office, Baker spends much of his time engaging community members on wildfire education and outreach, visiting neighborhoods, and talking to homeowners about how to take fire precautions in western forests that, as the climate gets drier and hotter, resemble tinderboxes more and more. I feel like half my job is psychology now, he said. People are looking to regulate their emotions by finding the ways so that what happened in LA wouldn't happen to them. Fire awareness is not new to Flagstaff or to any of the other communities along Arizona's elevated northern rim. But the 30 lives and $30 billion in real estate losses from the sudden and for many unexpected Los Angeles burn was sobering, and another indication of the shrinking divide between normal and new. Our community is ridiculously engaged in wildfire prevention, Baker said, adding that he had 70 volunteers signed up to help clear dry brush from a drainage ditch the following weekend. But it could happen anywhere. In the case of fire run wild, as landscapes desiccate and become crowded with ignition sources, timber, invasive grasses, and homes, anywhere increasingly does mean anywhere, to the point where a new, now normal term, urban conflagration, has emerged. We're building pretty close together, and often we're building without the understanding of how structure-to-structure ignition would happen, or how wildfire will impact the exterior of homes and then cause everything around them to burn and ignite the next property, said Michelle Steinberg, the Wildfire Division Director of the National Fire Protection Association. And that's called an urban conflagration. In Los Angeles, the fire postmortems included many experts pointing to the dense layout of the Pacific Palisades and Altadena neighborhoods, with crammed together houses separated by flammable privacy hedges, making the most of the seaside location as a clear warning sign. More than 16,000 structures burned and nearly 13,000 households were displaced. After the Marshall Fire, which killed two people and destroyed more than 1,000 structures in Colorado's Front Range as 2021 ticked over into 2022, the assessment was that high winds and a disconnected power line contributed to the blaze that skipped over ridgelines to torch rooftops much further apart than in LA. Compared to the pine-needled woodlands that previously put the wild in wildfire, a tidy expanse of million-dollar homes in view of endless ocean water or ranch-style sprawl along the shrubby highway to Denver wasn't most Americans' idea of high-risk landscapes for a devastating blaze. but as the act of burning fossil fuels for energy has supercharged not only the climate, but also the availability of most everything else on Earth to burn, insurance companies have been among the first to recognize the new urban conflagration normal by excluding homes across a range of Western settings from reasonably priced wildfire coverage. Now, Arizonans watching Angelino struggle to collect her disaster payouts and rise from the rubble are doubling down on making sure anywhere isn't here. We've seen an exponential increase in our workload to do home risk assessments since the Eaton and Palisades fires, said Paul Otrog, the Wildland Fire Battalion Chief with Flagstaff and Summit Fire and Medical. Before January, Otrog estimated they got about 5 requests per week from locals asking that a wildland fire expert visit their home and provide a free consultation on how they could reduce its risk of burning. After LA's urban conflagration, that number jumped to 25. No magic wand to build back better and also exactly as you were. One motivation to prevent urban conflagration is that rebuilding amid elevated labor costs, increased climate risk, supply chain issues, fluctuating materials tariffs, and a pre-existing national housing shortage is a challenging task to navigate. Add to that the cultural and emotional cost of a community losing its entire sense of place alongside its security and possessions, and you get a political recipe for what Steinberg says will be regrettable cuts to building regulations. I think probably one of the least popular things you can do as an elected official is to say, we're going to put more stringent codes in place because these people are now out of their homes and we can do it, Steinberg said. The time to strengthen your codes is well before you have an event. Both of these harsh and juxtaposing realities are playing out in California right now. The state made preemptive changes to adopt a building code with smarter criteria for wildfire protections, energy efficiency improvements, and more, Steinberg said. And they have a whole system of enforcement inspection that's right there. But Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass responded to pained public outcry from her grieving constituents, many of them among the country's wealthiest, by promising to cut code corners to allow for building back faster, if not necessarily better. In a January 13th executive order, she cleared the way to rebuild homes as they were by adjusting policies to bypass environmental reviews and expedite building permit approvals and safety inspections. In a series of state-level directives since January, California Governor Gavin Newsom did the same, issuing executive orders to suspend unnecessary permitting and review requirements to accelerate the rebuild. This approach all but guarantees a repeat disaster, while dismissing the lives lost in this one and baking more disadvantage into the system, Steinberg said. It's partially an attempt for leaders to tell people, we're going to try to make you whole, she said, but largely it's to support and reinstate the city's cash flows. The need for speed is not just about the victims themselves, Steinberg said. It's about the tax base. If you're in a city or county that relies on property tax, you can't continue to function if thousands of homes are gone. And that's a great encouragement for people to rebuild. But we should be looking for smart ways to show people the benefits of building back in safe and more sustainable ways, and we need to support people to come up to code who need the help. She gave an example of a pre-fire requirement in Louisville, Colorado, for new builds to include sprinkler systems that can help slow the spread of flames through a neighborhood long enough for fire crews to respond. It was pulled by city leaders in the aftermath of the Marshall Fire to facilitate rebuilding. There's no evidence cutting code corners speeds up the process, she said, but there is evidence that it increases the risk. Building industry folks say new requirements cost too much, and if they yell that loud enough, the elected officials get spooked, Steinberg said. but I think we need to come out strong for the safety of the community and say, for whom does it cost too much? Because to me, losing 16,000 homes and 30 lives costs way too much. And if we can prevent even some of that loss by building appropriately to the design standards we know will prevent tragedy, then we need to do it. Rebuilding in Los Angeles hasn't yet begun in most cases, but in Colorado, about 2/3 of the homes destroyed in the Marshall Fire have been rebuilt, with many of the remainder on pause due to stalled insurance payments. As the climate continues to warm and dry, they may be put to the flame test. There is no kind of magic wand we wave to get people back the way it was, Steinberg said. People talk about resilience, but I think what they mean is it's somehow going back to the way it was, and I don't ever see that happen with these kinds of massive events. Zone Zero, Getting Wise About Urban Fire. Eli Jensen studied age-old boots-on-the-ground forestry before deciding to teach himself advanced 3D laser scanning and spatial modeling techniques. He's been engaged in mapping tree density on undeveloped landscapes, sometimes using a high-resolution backpack scanner that can reproduce full forests on a computer screen in stunning, color-coded detail, and targeting trunks for removal in thinning projects for years. But in growing, housing-crunched Flagstaff, where he set up an office at the epicenter of the state's fire conversation, he saw a need for something new. In November, he launched a service offered by his company, Ironwood Forestry, for Arizona developers looking to plan out new neighborhoods while managing changing wildfire risk and city compliance codes. He's already got his hands full and is looking to bring on employees. There's not a lot of consulting foresters who are able to do these plans, Jensen said. I don't know how they did it in the past, but 30 years ago, we weren't thinking about FireWise and fire risk in the same way. Now we know better. On a drive through the Kachina Village settlement south of Flagstaff, Jensen explained the central tenets of the FireWise USA program, which was implemented in 2002 by the National Fire Protection Association, the nonprofit that Steinberg helps lead, as a response to the U.S. Forest Service lacking jurisdiction to manage fire risk in urban areas. All vegetation within 5 feet of any flammable structure should be removed. Branches overhanging rooftops should be cut back. Gutters should be cleared of dead leaves and debris, and gaps where embers could land should be closed. Overgrown grasses and shrubs that could serve as ladder fuels, lifting flames into tree canopies, should be trimmed. And pine needles and cones should be regularly hauled away from yards and community spaces. FireWise is a voluntary recognition program adopted and organized by neighborhoods for themselves that typically takes about a year to get going, but can result in reduced insurance premiums and a higher sense of community safety and collective defense against urban conflagration. In Kachina Village, those efforts have not taken root. There's been a half dozen initiatives to get Kachina Village to be a FireWise community, but they haven't stuck, Jensen said. The area falls, he said, in the category of poverty with a view. They might not have $10,000 to clear those trees. He pointed from his car window to one mobile home with invasive cedar shrubs right next to its exterior walls that he said are highly flammable due to their natural oils. Another residence had a pile of pine needles at the base of a slender tree overhanging its roof. But other neighbors had bagged up their needles and left them on the curb to be hauled away, likely signaling some local discord over disparity in efforts to reduce collective risk and preventative cost. Insurance companies don't always have very scientific ways of estimating fire risk for individual homes, Jensen said. I've heard stories that they'll look at the satellite imagery and just count trees and say, well, you have too many trees. He slowed his truck in front of one home tucked into a coniferous cove. But if you look at this, I mean, This tree by the power line, it's tall, it's got thick bark, the branches have been pruned. That's going to behave very, very differently than that short tree with a low crown, because it's the needles that are going to burn. In the absence of existing mandates from a homeowners association or government regulations that are slow to design and pass, it's difficult for cities or counties to do much about fire hazards in private yards that endanger the entire region. But Flagstaff has been working on tightening up requirements for new construction, and that's where Jensen comes in. Before developers can break ground in the city, they have to thin the forest to an acceptable ignition risk, he said, adding that how that is determined depends on the landscape, vegetation, and site-predictive fire spread maps. He thinks in the future he'll be consulting with insurance companies about the forestry science of risk. But that's a very crowded conversation, with many unknowns, he said. Right now, he's not offering any decisions or recommendations, just spatial data and the tools to use it to comply with city ordinances and FireWise guidance. In plenty of other neighborhoods in northern Arizona, residents are eager for recommendations and to leverage greater resources than are typical in Kachina Village to prevent their homes from the inferno. For now, that will have to do. And so it's what Flagstaff fire officials like Noah Baker and Paul Altrog are focused on. The goal will always be to inspire change from within the community rather than through a regulatory approach, Baker said, surrounded by ponderosa pines in Flagstaff's Thorpe Park. We call it Zone Zero, which is right from a homeowner's doorstep, Altrog added. In northern Arizona, we learn if we, God forbid, lose homes. Overall, Steinberg certifies Arizona as pretty proactive on reducing risk of wildfire and urban conflagration. It's among the top 10 states in terms of participation in FireWise, she said, with 10 out of 15 counties involved. There are 177 communities, self-defined, active in the program in Arizona, and that's growing all the time, Steinberg said. That represents almost 66,000 homes and 131,000 people protected. Certain communities have gone above and beyond. Last year, a majority of the 4,000 residents of Pine Top Lakeside in the White Mountains northeast of Phoenix approved an $11.6 million bond to build a new wildland fire station and purchase emergency equipment. It's a large expense for a small town, but worth it for those whose homes narrowly escaped becoming ash after the 2002 Rodeo Chudesky blaze, the state's largest at the time. They've also raised $300,000 to buy and manage risk in a wooded park in the center of town, and officials launched a new partnership with the nearby Novo Biopower plant in March to collect flammable green waste and use it to create electricity to power homes instead of burn them down. Wildfire is like the elephant in the room here, and this speaks to the community's concern, said resident Ryan Reinhold, who bought his first home in Pine Top Lakeside in 1976 and returned after evacuating in 2002, unsure of what was still there. Still, Pine Top Lakeside Mayor Stephanie Irwin said she watched the fires in Los Angeles with trepidation about Arizona's dry summer ahead. That could be us. We are a totally different environment, and I think Arizona is more progressive than California in terms of thinning and as far as the fire codes and taking care of our forests, she said. But I think we're all pretty terrified, and the wind is blowing terribly today. This is the earliest I've ever seen that we've got stage one fire restrictions. Both Irwin and Phil Good, the mayor of Prescott, a forested city of about 47,000 people northwest of Phoenix with a history of wildfire tragedy, said they would not support loosening safety requirements for rebuilding in the aftermath of a disaster like LA's. Even if we did have a wildfire that breached our border, chances are with all the efforts we make with FireWise accredited contractors, Our neighborhoods are not going to be as subject to fire risk as in LA, Good said. Those efforts in Prescott include a new 0.95% sales tax approved in November that went into effect in April to support a new fire station and upgrades to others. The city offers a $500 rebate for homeowners who bring in a landscaper to help firewise their property, which Good said he's seen reduce his own insurance premium. And the city updated its building codes in 2012 to include a requirement that new homes in the wildland urban interface either install sprinkler systems, which can cost between $10,000 and $20,000 per build, or that developers make sure there are multiple escape routes, dealer's choice. They've also worked with the utility Arizona Public Service to institute a public safety power shutoff program and to use infrared cameras that can detect unusual heat in areas of high risk as an early wildfire warning system. If we do the job we're expected to do as mayors, to protect the public and be able to communicate and inform them of the importance of this, then the chances of us having to deal with such a catastrophe are dramatically reduced, Good said. Not eliminated, but we can reduce it very, very significantly. APS has also worked with Bisbee near Arizona's border with Mexico to reduce fire risk by clearing dry brush and grass near its power poles. And the Superstition Fire and Medical District in Gold Canyon at the eastern edge of Metro Phoenix has a $33.8 million bond measure on its ballot this November that is similar to the one that passed in Pine Top Lakeside. But not all Arizona communities with wildfire risk are quite as aggressive. Steinberg said she was disappointed to see Payson, a forested community of 17,000, about halfway between Phoenix and Pine Top Lakeside, make some progress toward passing enforceable ordinances around fire safety in new buildings, but then drop it because they're a community that prefers to avoid regulation. Payson officials did not respond to the Arizona Republic's request for comment. She applauded Tucson, Tempe, outlying areas of Phoenix, and northern regions of Scottsdale for being reasonably engaged in wildfire risk reduction through FireWise protocols, despite less obvious risk in those desert landscapes. And she noted that others have started that process and are headed in the right direction. We've got a little groundswell in Sedona, but we'd like to see more activity there, Steinberg said. Flagstaff stands as the example to follow for wildfire prevention in Arizona. In 2010, the city of 76,000 passed a watershed protection plan with 70% voter approval to tax themselves $10 million for treatment work north of town that helps reduce wildfire risk. To me, that speaks to the informed and educated public that we get to work with here, Altrog said. Still, he said, the Flagstaff fire fleet is in a reactive phase of our fire prevention program, thanks to long overgrown forests, a warming climate, and recent funding cuts by the Trump administration that could affect important partnerships with the Coconino National Forest, the broader USFS, and other federal agencies that are critical for helping piece together fire protection across different land management categories. Heading into what may well be the hottest ever summer following one of the driest ever winters, they'll do the best they can with the help of a community willing to adapt and engage. I see a drive to make an effort and do a lot of inquiries to make new homes hardened to fire risk, Baker said. In northern Arizona, we learn if we, God forbid, lose homes. Be firewise for your neighbors, all of them. Homes in need of protection are not always made of lumber and nails. When social media was flooded with content about the Los Angeles fires at the beginning of this year, most of it focused on human distress and loss. But some algorithms surfaced the plight of wildlife as well. With nowhere to go and no pathways to safety, mobs of deer and droves of donkeys gathered in suburban streets just beyond the burning neighborhoods. A mountain lion and her cubs were seen running from the flames. These were apocalyptic sites, and they forced an inclusion of wildlife into the national conversation about wildfire preparation. Risks to furrier neighbors were already on the minds of fire professionals in parts of Arizona. "We're a municipality, so we prioritize protecting our residents," said Baker, Flagstaff's wildfire climate and community health specialist. "But we try to think about wildlife as well, and about pathways of that big future fire and doing prescribed burning so wildlife has a place to go." Scientists with the Arizona Department of Game and Fish and an engineering firm in Pine Top were also involved in research published in a peer-reviewed journal last fall about the need to consider future climate impacts like worsening wildfire when designing road infrastructure to facilitate wildlife movement and habitat connectivity. As wild species increase risk-taking behavior like crossing roads in response to disturbances such as wildfire, the authors wrote, the importance of securing safe passage over and under roadways will increase. This is vital protection not only for animals caught in the headlights, but also for the people in the cars that might hit them. But factoring this into transportation planning can be time-consuming and expensive. And since many wildlife crossing projects are funded in part with federal dollars, it requires a national recognition of the value of climate science. There are some really hard conversations going on in these communities right now about how we should be situated in these locations and how our land use, whether that's homes or agriculture, can shift to be more aligned with not only the natural flows of the environment and rivers, but also what's coming down the pipe in terms of climate change, said Caitlin Littlefield, a senior scientist with Conservation Science Partners and the lead author on the paper. Arizona has some wildlife crossings projects already in place or in the works, including 5 enlarged culverts under Loop 202 south of Phoenix that were completed by the Arizona Department of Transportation in 2019, and a wildlife overpass planned for outside of Flagstaff that was funded in 2023 with a $24 million grant from the Federal Highway Administration. But climate-intensified wildfires will require more, the scientists said. The more connectivity, the more animals are going to be able to respond to disturbances like wildfire. And that's the situation we're in, added Julia Kinch, a senior ecologist with the Colorado consulting firm Echo Resolutions, who also worked on the research paper. We do have to make difficult decisions and prioritize the areas where we are going to invest, not just in wildlife infrastructure, but also at the landscape scale, Kinch said. So whether that's land protection, ordinances, or regulations, how we develop the landscape to be more wildlife-friendly is really essential. Both scientists acknowledge the uncertainty introduced into climate mitigation projects by recent Trump administration funding cuts, which other reports found have also weakened the national firefighting force. Plans to resume closing gaps in the border wall between Arizona and Mexico could also take wildlife connectivity in the opposite direction. But they remain optimistic that the global momentum behind the need for wildlife crossings as a proven safety measure for drivers and a benefit for hunters would prevail. So many of these projects are occurring in Arizona, Nevada, Idaho, Wyoming. This is not a partisan issue, Kinch said. I think we're going to have to do some reframing, but our concept of wildlife crossings and the value of wildlife in the wild is a mainstream topic now, which it was not a decade ago. Watching over protections for humans against urban conflagration from her national nonprofit, Steinberg also emphasized reasons for hope amid all the physical destruction in Los Angeles. Tactical demolishing of the federal firefighting fleet and conceptual diminishment of wildlife and conservation science. That is, there's still a lot people can do to protect their homes right from their Zone Zero doorsteps. I think the good news piece is always really important because these kinds of events are so terrifying to people, and if we scare people too much, they freeze, Steinberg said. So we want to make sure people know what to look for so they're educated about their risk and the things they can do. And that feature article was entitled Hoping to Avoid Disaster, and that was by Joan Miners. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 8th, 2025. We're going to turn now to Valley and State News with this next article entitled Chandler Asks Voters to Decide on Mayor Council Term Limits. This is by Lauren DeYoung. Chandler residents will get to vote in November on whether to ratify city charter wording changes that could clear up confusion on term limits and affirm Mayor Kevin Hartke's two stints in office were legal. An overhaul of the current language would clarify term limits for council members and mayors after muddled wording left room for doubt and led to a lawsuit challenging the legitimacy of Hartke and two predecessors in the mayor's office. The proposed amendment, while not retroactively affecting sitting members, would affect the 2026 mayoral campaign of two-term councilmember Matt Orlando. The charter has been the object of scrutiny since Hartke submitted his interest to run for council in 2026 without taking a four-year break. He has served four consecutive terms, two each as a council member and mayor. His current term as mayor ends in 2026. During the charter review, City Attorney Kelly Schwab found two areas that needed immediate attention, causing an uproar over Hartke's position and City Manager Joshua Wright's contract. Wright announced his resignation on May 29th and his plans to take a job with the University of Arizona. It remains unclear when he applied. The announcement came 1 week after council members questioned whether his employment contract was consistent with what's allowed by the charter. The council addressed the city manager contract in a May 22nd council meeting and unanimously approved sending a proposed charter change to the voters in November. On June 2nd, the City Council voted to add a second charter amendment to the ballot. This one focused on the mayor and council term limits. Councilmember Jennifer Hawkins was the only one who dissented. She cited a need for more residents' voices to be involved in the amendment process. It's a disservice to our citizens, she said. But she noted there was urgency for confidence behind Matt Orlando's campaign that he's going to be able to be on the ballot. Most residents who spoke at the meeting, however, said the change was needed and the language proposed in the June 2nd meeting answered questions that lingered after a May 22nd council meeting. Chandler voters have overwhelmingly supported keeping term limits a total of 16 years, and this resolution keeps that intact, Chandler resident Beth Brazell said. Waiting until 2026 is not giving the voters the opportunity to have the charter clarified as soon as possible. The council cannot unilaterally change the charter. That power falls to the voters. However, the council can decide to hold a special election so residents can vote on the proposed changes. The city already had scheduled a bond election for November 4th, and the two charter amendments will be included on the ballot. The council also, on June 2nd, unanimously approved the formation of a charter review committee of city residents that will look over the charter and suggest areas that need improvement. What is the Chandler Term Limit Charter Amendment? The charter change would clarify what's been called ambiguous language about council member term limits. According to some legal interpretations, the current charter limits council members to 8 years consecutively in any position before having to take a four-year break, despite decades of an interpretation allowing council members turn mayors to serve 16 years in a row. This new interpretation is key to a lawsuit against Hartke and the city. The plaintiff, Ruth Jones, Hartke's 2022 mayoral opponent, claimed that Hartke's two terms as mayor violated the charter because he served two terms on the council before being elected mayor. The lawsuit called for Hartke to immediately step down. Jones declined to comment May 28th. It was unclear why she filed the lawsuit only now. The council discussed the lawsuit in a behind-closed-doors meeting before the June 2nd public meeting. What was said in that session is confidential by state law. What was voted on in public, the proposed charter language, focuses on three main areas. One would officially authorize 16 consecutive years on the council, two terms as a council member and two terms as a mayor. The change would also reinforce that Hartke and his two predecessors held the mayor's seat legally. The second reaffirms that council members cannot serve more than two consecutive terms on the council. They either have to be elected as mayor or take a four-year break. The third focuses on council members in staggered elections. In Chandler, three seats for council are up for grabs every other year. The mayor position is open every 4 years, causing issues for those who are not elected in the same year as the mayor. Under the old language, there was confusion as to whether a council member like Vice Mayor Christine Ellis would be eligible to run for mayor. Hartke was elected in 2022 and his term ends in 2026. The next mayor will serve from 2026 to 2030. But Ellis was elected in 2024 and her term ends in 2028, meaning she would have had to sit out for 4 years before running for any position again and missing out on the next mayoral election. The new language clarifies that if she wanted to run for mayor in 2030, she would be eligible to run and serve 2 years as mayor if elected. And that article is entitled, Chandler Asks Voters to Decide on Mayor Council Term Limits, and that was by Lauren DeYoung. Our next article is entitled, Queen Creek, Third Area and State to Get Google Fiber. This is by Maritza Dominguez. Google Fiber has broken ground in Queen Creek, the company announced on its social media channels. It's the third Arizona area after Mesa and Chandler to land Google's internet service. Queen Creek approved a measure that allows Google to use the town's right-of-way to install its infrastructure in December 2023. Fiber internet is viewed as a better alternative to cable internet because it uses fiber optic cables to send data through thin strands of fiberglass at nearly the speed of light, compared to using slower copper wires to deliver internet. The company, in an announcement, stated that its estimated service will start in early 2026. However, it did not state any specific service areas. Efforts to identify new internet providers for residents had been ongoing. In the spring 2023, Queen Creek hired a consultant to do a town-wide fiber assessment to assist in identifying gaps in fiber infrastructure. West Mesa residents were the first people in Arizona to receive Google Fiber service in March 2023. Service for Chandler residents went online in December. In 2012, Kansas City residents were the first to get the faster fiber cable. The company's presence in the East Valley continues to expand, including opening its first brick-and-mortar office space in Mesa. Will Novak, a government and community affairs manager, told the Arizona Republic that he's heard from residents that Google Fiber's presence has helped drive prices down from competitive internet providers. Novak could not share data on how many customers have signed up for Google Fiber in the Valley, saying the company does not release that information. He said the company anticipates announcing service in other Metro Phoenix cities later this year. What is Google Fiber? Google Fiber is a subsidiary of Alphabet Inc., the umbrella company for other Google companies. The company digs a shallow trench nearly 2 inches wide along the street to lay down the fiber optic cable. Service plans start at $70 per month for a 1 gigabyte per second of download and upload speed. Google Fiber's 1 gigabyte plan can download a movie in 56.9 seconds or a 10 gigabyte game in 1.5 minutes. A $150 per month plan offers up to 8 gigabytes per second of download and upload speed. Google Fiber offers the highest gigabyte service in the industry next to Optium, USA Today reported. According to speedtest.net, the average U.S. download speed as of April 2025 was 291.8 Mbps. Google Fiber download speed for the 1 gigabyte service is 1,000 Mbps. And that article is entitled, Queen Creek, Third Area and State to Get Google Fiber, and that was by Maritza Dominguez. This next article is entitled, Affordable Build-to-Rent Homes Coming to Maricopa. This is by Catherine Rieger. Affordable housing builder Dominium is developing build-to-rent homes in the city of Maricopa that will be priced below market rate leases. The 215 single-family development called Saddleback Village at Stonegate is going up near Porter Road and Allen Stevens Parkway. The homes will be available to people earning 60% or less of the median income, which for Pinal County ranges from $47,160 for one person to $78,120 for six people. Build-to-rent homes are constructed as rentals and not sold to home buyers. The growing trend started in Metro Phoenix, and the Valley ranks in the top three U.S. markets for the most build-to-rent homes. Maricopa's projected growth makes it a good place for the apartment developer to launch its first build-to-rent community, according to Dominium. Build-to-rent is a great opportunity for people who aren't ready to buy but also want the amenities of a single-family home, said Ron Mell, Senior Vice President and Project Partner at Dominium. Dominium is a national affordable rental developer with new apartment complexes across the valley. The homes will come with granite countertops, vinyl plank flooring, carpeting, designer lighting, walk-in closets, bike storage, and key fob entry access. The community also will have playgrounds and other outdoor spaces. Maricopa is thrilled Dominium is developing high-quality, affordable housing options, said Maricopa Mayor Nancy Smith. Workforce housing contributes to a healthy, vibrant economy that will help families thrive. Saddleback Village at Stonegate will offer two-bedroom, three-bedroom, and four-bedroom homes ranging from 910 square feet to 1,442 square feet. The typical 900-square-foot Valley rental home leases for about $1,250 a month, according to the Arizona Regional Multiple Listing Service. That article is entitled, Affordable Build-to-Rent Homes Coming to Maricopa, and that was by Catherine Rieger. Now we're going to move to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We'll start with two front page articles, one on food banks and the second on protesters against ICE raids. This first article is entitled A Shrinking Lifeline with the subtitle Federal Aid Cuts Hit Ohio Food Banks Amid Trump Austerity Push. This is by PJ Huffstutter. On a warm spring morning, volunteers at the Mid-Ohio Food Collective plucked cucumbers from a greenhouse where a state psychiatric hospital once stood and the land lay fallow. Now the state's largest food bank is working that ground again, part of an urgent effort to shore up supplies amid shrinking federal support, including deep funding cuts under President Donald Trump. They are planting more, prepping soil for fruit trees, and installing hives for honey. In the greenhouse, crates of romaine and butterhead lettuce were packed for delivery, bound for a pantry across town. Back at headquarters in Grove City, staff chased leads from grocers, manufacturers, even truckers looking to unload abandoned freight. Every pallet helped. Every pound counted. In a state that handed Trump three straight wins, where Trump flags flap near food aid flyers pinned on bulletin boards, the cost of his austerity push is starting to show. Food banks will still have food, said Mid-Ohio CEO Matt Habash. But with these cuts, you'll start to see a heck of a lot less food or pantries and agencies closing. You're going to have a lot of hungry and a lot less healthy Americans. For decades, food banks like Mid-Ohio have been the backbone of the nation's anti-hunger system, channeling government support and donations from corporations and private donors into meals and logistics to support pantries at churches, nonprofits, and other organizations. If a food bank is a warehouse, food pantries are the store. Outside one of those, the Eastside Community Ministry Pantry in rural Muskegon County, Ohio, Mary Dotson walked slow, cane in hand. The minute she stepped through the doors, her whole body seemed to lift. They call her Mama Mary here, as she's got the kind of voice that settles you down and straightens you out in the same breath. The regulars grin as Dotson, 77, pat shoulders, swaps recipes. She had tried to do everything right, built a career, raised five children, planned for the quiet years with her husband. But after he died and the kids moved away, the life they'd built slipped out of reach. Now her monthly Social Security check is $1,428. She budgets $70 of that for groceries, and she gets $23 in food benefits as well. She started as a volunteer at Eastside. Simple math convinced her to become a customer. I figured if I'm going to take these things, Dotson said, I'm going to work here, too. The Mid-Ohio Food Collective was born out of church basements and borrowed trucks nearly half a century ago when factory closures left more families hungry. It's now the state's largest food bank, feeding more than 35,000 Ohio families a week. It supplies more than 600 food pantries, soup kitchens, children and senior feeding sites, after-school programs, and other partner agencies. When Trump returned to office in January, Mid-Ohio was already slammed. Pantry visits across its 20 counties hit 1.8 million last year, nearly double pre-COVID levels, and are continuing to grow this year. The biggest surge came from working people whose paychecks no longer stretch far enough due to pandemic-era inflation under Joe Biden's presidency, staff said. Then came the Trump cuts. In March, the U.S. Department of Agriculture canceled the pandemic-era Local Food Purchase Assistance Program, which funded about $500 million annually for food banks, and froze about $500 million in funding for the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP, one of the agency's core nutrition programs that supplies food to states to pass on to food banks for free. Much of the food Mid-Ohio distributes is donated, but donations alone can't stock a pantry consistently. Its current $11.1 million purchasing budget, built from federal, state, and private dollars, helps fill the gaps. The March cuts wiped out about 22% of Mid-Ohio's buying power for the next fiscal year, funds and food that staff are trying to replace. In early December, Mid-Ohio ordered 24 truckloads filled with milk, meat, and eggs for delivery this spring and summer. The food came through the TFAP program, using about $1.5 million in government funding. The first delivery was scheduled to show up April 9th. The only thing to arrive was a cancellation notice. USDA said in a statement that Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins is working to ensure federal nutrition spending is efficient, effective, and aligned with the administration's budget priorities. More cuts could come. In May, the Republican-controlled House passed Trump's tax and spending bill. It called for $300 billion in cuts to food benefits for low-income people under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which fed nearly 1.4 million Ohioans in January, according to the latest state data. If the cuts survive the Senate and are passed into law, it annually would cost Ohio at least $475 million in state funding to maintain current SNAP benefits, plus at least $70 million for administrative program costs, said Cleveland-based the Center for Community Solutions, an independent nonpartisan policy research group. That would consume nearly every state-controlled dollar in Ohio's Department of Job and Family Services budget, roughly 95% of the general revenue meant to help fund everything from jobless claims to foster care. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and lawmakers in the state's GOP supermajority legislature, facing a constitutional requirement to pass a balanced budget, told Reuters that extra money for food banks isn't there. The proposed fiscal 2025 Ohio budget would set food bank funding back to 2019 levels, or about 23% less than what it spent this year, in a state where nearly one in three people qualify for help. Saving a penny. So what happens when the government pulls back and supplies thin? If you're Victoria Brown and her small team of four, it means working the phones, chasing leads, watching markets, and moving fast. At Mid-Ohio's offices in Grove City, the food bank's director of sourcing sipped her coffee and squinted at her screen, eyes tracking the price per pound of cucumbers down to the cent. Saving a penny might seem inconsequential unless you're trying to buy 40,000 pounds. In a supply chain that has relied on steady government support, food donations have become even more important, even as they grow more haphazard in both timing and what's available. Outside Brown's office, one staffer was trying to track down a shipment of pineapples. The rest were on the road, talking crop conditions with farmers, negotiating delivery times with suppliers, and checking with grocers to see what might be sitting in the back waiting for a second life. Racing the clock. Some of that food may be headed for Mid-Ohio's Norton Market, a modern food pantry built to feel like a real store in Columbus. The man in charge here is Denver Burkhart. He moves with the kind of precision the military teaches and life reinforces. At 35, he looks every bit the soldier he still is, broad-shouldered and lean, squared off at the edges. 15 years in the Army, 2 tours in Afghanistan, and 1 in Iraq, now he has a mission back home until he serves overseas again with the Ohio Army National Guard. He started the morning as he always does, at a laptop in the back cramped office, racing to secure whatever free or discounted goods Brown's team had found. He leaned over the keyboard, one eye on the clock, the other on the blinking screen. The inventory system had just refreshed. The race was on to fill his mental list. His fingers clicked fast, steady, practiced. He hovered over baby formula. More moms had been showing up lately. 40 cases into the cart. Maybe too many, but if he waited, they'd be gone. "I rely heavily on the free product," he said. "Without it, we'd be hurting really bad." Water days. Across town, Shannon Follins checks on her ice supply. It's for what she calls the water days. Follins, 37, is raising 3 kids, including 3-year-old twins. One is autistic. He hasn't found his words yet. Until recently, Follins worked third shift at Waffle House for $5.25 an hour, and now she's studying for a degree in social services. Family members bring groceries when they can, but it's the pantry at Broad Street Presbyterian Church, stocked by Mid-Ohio, that lets her make meals that feel like more than survival. One recent night, her daughter Essence twirled barefoot across their kitchen floor, dancing to the sounds of boiling pasta and chicken simmering in the pan. When there was nothing else to eat, she filled her kids' bellies with tap water and a mother's promise that tomorrow might be better. "It gives me a sense of security," she said, nodding toward the plastic jugs stacked at her freezer. If the government cuts food aid, she's prepared for more water days. And that article was entitled A Shrinking Lifeline, and that was by P.J. Huffstutter. Our second front page article from USA Today is entitled Protesters rally against ICE for second day in LA. The subtitle is Trump Administration to Deploy National Guard. This is by Sandra Stojanovic and Omar Yunus. President Donald Trump's administration said it would deploy 2,000 National Guard troops on June 7th as federal agents in Los Angeles faced off against demonstrators for a second day following immigration raids. The security agents confronted around 100 protesters in the Paramount area in southeast Los Angeles, where some demonstrators displayed Mexican flags and others covered their mouths with respiratory masks. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, told Fox News that the National Guard would be deployed in Los Angeles late on June 7th. California Governor Gavin Newsom called the decision purposefully inflammatory. If Governor Gavin Newsom of California and Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles can't do their jobs, which everyone knows they can't, then the federal government will step in and solve the problem, riots and looters, the way it should be solved, Trump posted on his Truth Social platform. The protests pit Democratic-run Los Angeles, where census data suggests a significant portion of the population is Hispanic and foreign-born, against Trump's Republican White House, which has made cracking down on immigration a hallmark of his second term. In the late afternoon, authorities began detaining some protesters, according to Reuters witnesses. There was no immediate official information of any arrests. Video footage showed dozens of green-uniformed security personnel with gas masks lined up on a road strewn with overturned shopping carts as small canisters exploded into gas clouds. Now they know that they cannot go to anywhere in this country where our people are and try to kidnap our workers, our people. They cannot do that without an organized and fierce resistance, said protester Ron Gochez, 44. A first round of protests kicked off on the night of June 6th after Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents conducted enforcement operations in the city and arrested at least 44 people on alleged immigration violations. That is all the time that we have for this last article from USA Today, entitled Protesters Rally Against ICE for Second Day in LA. That was by Sandra Stojanovic and Omar Yunus. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, June 8th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can hear Sun Sounds also on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.